This Week in Nuclear, episode number 67 for June 6, 2009. This is John Wheeler. Welcome to the show. You ever notice that the numbers we use in daily conversation seem to keep getting bigger and bigger? When I was young, my father once pointed out to me that a family who had $1 million could live off the interest alone and would never have to work again. In fact, he told me they'd have a tough time spending it all. While that was certainly true at the time, the value of $1 million is not what it used to be. Here's a little audio bite from one of my favorite movie villains that illustrates this point.
Here's the plan. We get the warhead and we hold the world ransom for $1 million.
Well, don't you think we should maybe ask for more than $1 million? $1 million isn't exactly a lot of money these days. Virtucon alone makes over $9 billion a year.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot. Okay, then. We hold the world ransom for $100 billion.
Even Dr. Evil had trouble comprehending the size of $1 billion. But what about hundreds of billions or even a trillion? We hear and read those numbers in the news and in conversation, but what do they really mean? It's easy to understand the number of zeros that make them different, but that's pretty abstract. I contend that many of us really don't comprehend how large those numbers are when it comes to measuring things in the real world. We need visual or mental references to help us understand the scale of such large quantities. Let's use electrical power as an example. The base unit of measure for electrical power is the watt. But what are the differences between 1 watt, a kilowatt, a megawatt, and a gigawatt? Well, 1 watt is barely enough power to light a small incandescent light bulb like a bathroom nightlight. The next step up, a kilowatt, or 1,000 watts, is about 1.3 horsepower. About the same energy output as a small lawnmower engine, and the average household in the United States uses about 1 kilowatt of electricity on an ongoing basis if you take an average over the entire year. After a kilowatt, the next step up is a megawatt, which is 1,000 kilowatts or 1 million watts. 1 megawatt is enough electricity to power a small town. Large diesel locomotive engines generate in the range of 3 to 5 megawatts, to give you an idea. After that, we come to a gigawatt, or 1 billion watts. A gigawatt is about the size of a large central station power plant, and it's enough energy to power about 1 million homes. After a gigawatt, the next step up is a terawatt, or 1 trillion watts. And this is energy on a continental scale. In fact, the total worldwide electricity demand is about 15 terawatts. And now to the real point of this show, I want to speak to you about carbon capture and storage and the scale of the challenge this concept presents. To put it bluntly, the scale is bigger than huge. It's even bigger than enormous. The amount of carbon dioxide gas released by coal and natural gas power plants is planetary in scale. And let me describe what I mean by that. The U.S. Department of Energy estimates that the U.S. and Canada stationary power plants produce 3.8 billion tons of CO2 per year, and the total worldwide each year is 33 billion tons. But really, how big is that? Well, here's the answer. At standard temperature and pressure, One ton of CO2 occupies 556 cubic meters. That's a little larger, by the way. This is one ton of CO2. It's a little larger than the volume of a typical 2,000 square foot home. Still a little tough to visualize, though, because we're talking about 33 billion tons. And I just spoke about the volume of one ton. Well, the International Carbon Bank and Exchange did some calculations for us, and there are links in the show notes. The USA's emissions of CO2 each year would cover every square foot of the continental United States to a depth of 1 foot. Let me repeat that so it'll start to sink in a little bit. Burning fossil fuels is producing enough CO2 waste to blanket the entire continental United States to a depth of 1 foot every year. As I said, this is a problem on a planetary scale. And from a very common sense point of view, the challenge of compressing that enormous volume of gas or converting it to liquid or solid and then storing it in a way that it cannot escape for several hundred years is simply not doable. I'm not being pessimistic, just practical. And it's a huge waste of time and resources to embark on a path down that course, to even attempt to capture and store CO2 when there's another proven solution already. That solution is don't create the CO2 to begin with. Nuclear energy is already a tried and true technology that produces virtually no CO2. Now, anti-nuclear people will tell you that nuclear energy does create CO2 because of the energy used in fabricating the fuel and manufacturing the building materials and in plant construction. And yes, that's true, but it's a very, very small amount by comparison. Plus, if we ran our electric grid on nuclear energy, then most of that energy for fabrication would be generated without emitting greenhouse gas. Since I'm talking about the scale of waste products produced, I have to mention the mountains of solid waste produced every year by coal plants. A typical large coal power plant burns the equivalent of a 2-mile-long coal train every day. That's a 700-mile-long train every year. And since up to 10% of that original coal ends up as solid waste, every coal plant disposes the equivalent of a 70-mile-long train of toxic ash every year. Now, some of that goes up into the air that we have to breathe. The rest goes into landfills, slurry ponds, or in other disposal methods. The entire world uses about 6 billion tons of coal each year. That's a pile of coal 1 mile high and 2.25 miles across. If we use the same ratio for the ash that's generated, then we will generate 600 million tons of solid coal waste every year. And there's another big number, 600 million tons. Well, to give you a mental model of how much waste that is a pile of waste more than 500 feet high. Higher than 3 Statues of Liberty stacked one on top of another. By comparison, all of the nuclear plants in the United States create only 2,000 tons per year of used fuel. And if you took all of the used fuel from all of the commercial reactors that have been generating 20% of the USA's electricity for the last 40 years, it would all fit on one football field to a depth of only 7 meters. That used nuclear fuel is in the form of a stable ceramic material encased in corrosion-resistant metal, and it can be very easily and very safely stored until it is recycled or processed to remove valuable materials contained inside. The problem of trying to capture and store such an enormous volume of CO2 from coal plants is practically unimaginable. And even if we are able to capture and store it all, we'd still have to keep it contained for more than 100 years. On the opposite end of the spectrum, the amount of used fuel generated by nuclear plants is minuscule and can be easily stored and monitored. It's common sense, but sometimes the truth is obscured by the numbers. Here's Dr. Evil again a few scenes later in the movie when he's attempting to blackmail the leaders of the world.
Gentlemen, my name is Dr. Evil. In a little while, you'll notice that the Kreplakistani warhead has gone missing. If you want it back, you're going to have to pay me $1 million. Sorry. $100 billion.
Gentlemen, silence.
Now,
Mr. Evil.
Dr. Evil. I didn't spend 6 years in Evil Medical School to be called Mr. Thank you very much.
So next time you hear someone talking about spending billions of dollars on carbon capture and storage research projects in the hope of someday enabling us to keep burning coal without emitting CO2, ask yourself, I wonder if they've ever listened to Dr. Evil. For quite a while I've been debating the argument that nuclear energy is equally renewable as energy derived from hydro, wind, and biomass. My thought process goes like this. Rivers go dry with overuse in periods of drought, and the winds shift with changing weather patterns, such as those that will occur with global climate change. The availability of biomass is dependent on favorable weather and must be replenished using agricultural processes that are reliant on fossil fuels. The ultimate energy source of all these renewables is the sun, and while the sun is not infinite, it's unlikely to extinguish before or during the course of human existence. The availability of the sun to replenish hydro, wind, and biomass energy make these energy sources renewable. In contrast, the source of nuclear energy is fuel that is contained entirely on planet Earth. And while there are certainly a finite number of uranium and thorium atoms on the planet, the supply will last for as long as human beings need it. The myth propagated by the anti-nuclear crowd that we will run out of fuel for nuclear reactors is simply untrue. They grossly underestimate the amount of uranium that exists, and they discount already proven technologies like breeder reactors, and they ignore the existence of thorium, a fuel that's even more plentiful than uranium. We have enough nuclear fuel to last for more than 1,000 years, even if we expand the number of nuclear plants by more than a factor of 10. This makes nuclear energy better than renewable, in my mind. It's virtually inexhaustible. And I've discussed often how the renewable portfolio standards that are being proposed will encourage investment in wind and solar, but alone will not result in desired reductions in CO2 emissions. If the goal is CO2 reduction, then why not promote the expansion of nuclear energy, the greatest source of low-carbon energy in existence? Keith Johnson of the Wall Street Journal blog discusses the renewable question and issues surrounding the logic of a national renewable portfolio standard. I have a link to his post in the show notes. In particular, Keith points out the inconsistencies in the Waxman-Markey approach to fighting climate change. Here's what he says. Nuclear power proponents are puzzled by what seems a logical inconsistency on the part of Democrats who consistently shoot down the nuclear energy proposals. If the goal is to promote low-emission power sources, then nuclear power should be part of the mix. If the goal is to promote new power sources, then existing wind and solar facilities shouldn't be showered with federal goodies. That is, states that already have loads of wind power would already be halfway to meeting the new renewable energy targets without building any new clean energy. And he adds later, if the whole game in Washington is meant to be about producing electricity with fewer emissions of greenhouse gases, then it seems odd that nuclear power wouldn't be under consideration. Take some time and read the blog and browse the comments. Some of them are excellent. Other comments by anti-nuclear activists serve to illustrate my very point, and the point that Mr. Johnson makes in his article, that climate change advocates who argue against nuclear energy simply don't make sense. One of the best comments was by a fellow blogger, Jim Holm, who provides a great example for the nuclear equals renewable case. Jim said, "As dissolved in seawater, uranium is a renewable resource. It comes from mountain granite washed down to the sea as sand, finally leached out as uranium. Every year, this source of sand is renewed by winter weathering. The Japanese developed a process that can extract it from seawater for about 4 times the current street price." Great post, Jim, and you can check out Jim's website at www.coal2nuclear.com. That's coal, then the number 2, nuclear.com, and that's in the show notes as well. And by the way, William Tucker's great book called Terrestrial Energy has influenced my opinions on this topic. That's it for this week. This is John Wheeler for This Week in Nuclear. Have a great week.